My name is Mark Schwain, and I come from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach at Valparaiso University. And I've been offering a series of sessions this week, and this is the last one on the life and work of Norman MacLean. I can just give you a brief review of the material covered. I started just with some brief biographical background, and then did a session on River Runs Through It, and then a session on Young Men and Fire, and now a session pulling from things called The Stakes of Stories, the Theology of Norman MacLean. So the plan will be that first say a little bit about the warrant that is the grounds for thinking about MacLean as a kind of theologian. He would not like to be characterized as a theologian. In fact, there's some handouts there on the table you might want to get. In fact, he'd probably be horrified by that. He was the son of a pastor, though. And as I indicated in my very first session, and as you can see from the very first page of his book, River Runs Through It, that was to have a lasting effect on him. And the scriptures were certainly one of the three major literary influences, not to say spiritual influence on his life, the other two being the Romantic poets, especially Wordsworth, and the tragedies of Shakespeare. Some of you who have arrived in the village since last week didn't get to hear what I provided doing the work on his life, which is to hear him reading in his own voice. So I thought I'd give you just a sample of the very beginning of A River Runs Through It. And I'm not going to play as much as I did the last time, but when you hear the first line, you'll understand why it's pretty good to talk about, or makes a lot of sense to talk about, the theology of Norman MacLean.
In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John the Favorite was a dry fly fisherman. I write like paragraphs. Yeah, a pardon is very important to me as a unit, as a unit in the narration, and as a sound unit too. I have a feeling that it ought to be like a little blot. It starts, it gets kind of complicated as in the middle, and then it kind of resolves itself at the end. Although only partly resolves itself at the end, because it also should be throwing itself ahead for the next paragraph. The paragraphs are very, everybody has, I suppose, a different unit that he works by, but paragraphs are about as close as my favorite as any of them.
So that gives you a clue when you're reading MacLean that he thinks of each paragraph, and sometimes they're very short, just three sentences, as having, maybe you couldn't hear his word clearly, they're their own little plot. So they, each paragraph has its own structure, with a kind of beginning and a middle and an end, and then that end kind of thrusts you forward into the next paragraph and so forth. So I just thought you'd be interested in hearing that little discourse on his own writing. But the main point of playing that was to just let you hear him in his own voice, but also to show you that from the very beginning of this book that he was 70 before he began to write it, you get this statement that there was no clear line between fly fishing and religion in his family, and that should be also a clue, it seems to me, that when we read this book, which is in one sense all about fly fishing on one level, on another sense in being about fly fishing, it's also profoundly, profoundly theological. And those are some of the things that we want to try now to tease out. So let's talk about some of the theological then dimensions first of Young, first of River Runs Through It. For those of you who were here on the day we did that, you'll remember that I talked about that book as having very clearly four parts, which coincide with the rhythm of fly fishing, which he says is done on a four-count rhythm, which is how his father taught them to cast for trout, fly fish, and that each of the four parts has central to it fishing, all but one on the Great Blackfoot River, the Big Blackfoot, and that really the one of the major threads that flows through all four of those chapters is the whole question of what it means to help someone. And very early on in a passage that I read, and now I'm going to read once more, in the transition in the first part of the book from a kind of prelude to the actual action of the first part, he has the following statement to make about him and his brother. And of course, it's that relationship will be central to the book. He says, "Perhaps we wondered which one of us was tougher, but if boyhood questions aren't answered before a certain point in time, they can't ever be raised again. So we return to being gracious to each other, as the wall, which said, 'God is love,' suggested that we should be. We felt that the woods and rivers were gracious to us when we walked together beside them." So right there you have graciousness, or the whole theme of grace, and you have toughness, which in their idiom meant a kind of struggle, kind of effort, a kind of exertion. And without going through the whole session, which some of you heard, let me just say that one way to look at the plot of this book is to view it as people trying to help each other, especially the father and the two sons, but not only them, and basically feeling that they were failing, or that they fell short, or that the tragedy of Paul's death was due to their failing to help him, but at the same time showing, against the telling, these people helping each other a great deal, always in the course of fishing together. Fishing together is a kind of helping. And so there's at one and the same time the fear and the worry over failure, even as these people immersed in these waters are actually helping one another. The other theme in there, or the other plot development, a kind of subplot, is Norman and Paul trying to help Norman's brother-in-law, Neil. And one of the reasons that it seems to me, we're led to see, doesn't work out on any level as a kind of helping is that they never manage to get Neil into the water. They keep taking Neil fishing, but on a couple of occasions, though they get him near the water, they never get him into it. And so the fact is that since they are all in the water, that is to say the father and the two boys in the last scene and the two boys in all of the preceding three parts, that tells you, it seems to me, something very important and gets us into a kind of another level of the theology here. Another way of putting this question about their graciousness to each other, and notice in the passage that I just read to you, the woods being gracious to them. So there's this relationship between nature and the two of them toward each other being gracious, but yet this continual frustration that they're inadequate to the task of helping. Another way to kind of get at that whole issue, but to frame it even more largely, is to look at another theological theme that comes up in the passage that I've passed out here. So if you turn to the shorter of the two passages, which is really the last paragraph, or I should say the last page of the novel, let's look there and see how this all resolves itself. He says, this is the narrator now, speaking years and years later, in terms of later in the action of the story. The action of the story is over now. Paul is many years dead, and the narrator is now speaking and says, "Now, nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them." Now, I think this is important. Norman never wastes any words. "Now, nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young." I mean, that opens up the possibility, since the whole frustration of people being able really fully to understand one another is a theme in here, that he maybe has come to understand his father, his brother, and other of those whom he loved. But how? Well, what immediately precedes this, and you don't have this on your sheet, is the close of a conversation that he and his father are having. And that conversation runs right up to this passage you have in front of you, and I'm going to read you that. He says, the narrator, "Indirectly, Paul was present in many of our conversations. Once, for instance, my father asked me a series of questions that suddenly made me wonder whether I had understood even my father, whom I felt closer to than any man I have ever known. 'You like to tell true stories, don't you?' he asked. I answered, 'Yes, I like to tell stories that are true.' Then he asked, 'After you have finished your true stories sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us.'" So the father is recommending that Norman someday, as he puts it here, makes up some stories. And Norman's whole, I think, writing life, and this comes out in both of these stories, is always wondering about, in an effort to tell the truth, where you draw the line between what you're sort of making up and what you're recording actually happened. And so he wants to be truthful, meaning he doesn't want to be false to what actually happened. He wants to tell the truth about it. And sometimes he sees that in order to tell the deep truth of what happened, you have to make a few things up, and that just telling what actually happened is not going to do as much justice to the truth as making some things up along the way. In an interview he gave shortly before his death, the interviewer asked him this question: "When you were writing your stories, how did they change as you turned them into fiction?" And here's what he says: "They changed long before I started writing them. I'm not sure that after a few years, I could tell what happened from what I say happened, which is fortunate if you want to be a storyteller. I had a drenching of storytelling in all the years when I was in the Forest Service and logging camps, and so it's easier for me to tell a story about what happened than telling it exactly as it happened. I'll read that again. It's easier for me to tell a story about what happened than telling it exactly as it happened. In other words, they became stories long before I told them." Now, the more you read McLean, the more you realize that they became stories long before he told them, all right, and he wants to be arguing in much of his work that in some sense they were stories even before they happened. That is, in some sense, what he does when he thinks about his own life and when he thinks about the lives in the Young Men in Fire that he describes there, these 13 men who lost their lives, is that what he's doing really is as much finding a story as he is making a story. And actually, as he finally comes down, he's both finding stories and making stories at the same time. Now, just be patient with me, and I'm going to get around to the theological point here, but I first have to make this sort of literary one. So to make the theological point on the stakes of stories and why it's important to see that for him, finding them and making them are part and parcel of the same vocation that he has as a writer, I'm going to take us through a rather more difficult passage, and a river runs through it. And I ask you to bear with me as I kind of read it and comment on it. As I said the first day that I talked about a river runs through it, it's beautifully and perfectly structured into these four parts. And at the center of the four parts, we get the passage that you have in front of you that's the longer of the two. And in the interest of ecology, I have not Xeroxed two other pages that kind of are part of this, because it's I'm going to read you what leads up to what you have here, and then study closely what you have in front of you. So here's what leads up to what you have there. He's going to be reflecting now on the bank of a river, and he's just walked over a dead beaver that smells to high heaven, and he's just left behind this terrible brother-in-law and this prostitute his brother-in-law is with. And now he's sitting at the bank having done some fishing, and here's what he says. I sat there in the hot afternoon trying to forget the beaver and trying to think about the beer that they buried in the stream before they went fishing. Trying to forget the beaver, I also tried to forget my brother-in-law and old Rawhide. I knew I was going to have a long time to sit here and forget, because my brother would never quit with three or four fish as I had, and even he was going to have a hard time getting more. I sat there and forgot, until what remained was the river that went by and I who watched. On the river, the heat mirages danced with each other, and then they danced through each other, and then they joined hands and danced around each other. Eventually, the watcher joined the river, and there was only one of us. I believe it was the river. Okay, so here you see and acted now something that you're going to hear stated again in that great ending about things merging into one. Here he's become one with the river in this moment, just before the passage that you have in front of you. He says then, even the anatomy of a river was laid bare. Not far downstream was a dry channel where the river had run once. And part of the way to come to know a thing is through its death. But years ago, I had known the river when it flowed through this now dry channel. So I could enliven its stony remains with the water of the memory. Now, let's just pause there. So he becomes one with the river, and then he sees this dry channel, and he realizes that you come to know a thing partly through its death. And he then makes the move to note that through the waters of memory, he can enliven it. He can bring, in a sense, the river to life through these life-giving waters of memory. Now, you read that passage and you realize, well, yeah, this is now something he's doing through the waters of his own memory, and he's not going to bring that river alive as an artist in the next paragraph. But you realize this also works for what he's doing with his brother in the book. Okay? So you realize as you're reading this that on one level, this actually is an event in the story where he's bringing the river to life through his memory of it, this dead channel. But on another level, it describes his work as an artist in the book, bringing his brother alive through the waters of memory, his dead brother Paul. Okay. So now he talked about the waters of memory. Now we go to the artist. In death, that is the river now, it had its pattern. It had its pattern. And we can only hope for as much. That is, we can only hope that our lives too are seen to have, as we look back on them, and as we actually live them, a kind of pattern. Its overall pattern was the favorite serpentine curve of the artist, sketched on the valley from my hill, that is the hill where he was sitting, to the last hill I could see on the other side. But internally, it was made of sharp angles. It ran seemingly straight for a while, turned abruptly, then ran smoothly again, then met another obstacle, again was turned sharply, and again ran smoothly. Straight lines that couldn't be exactly straight, and angles that couldn't have been exactly right angles, became the artist's most beautiful curve, and swept from here across the valley to where it could no longer, could be no longer seen. Okay, so now you have, again, a wonderful thing that works at two levels. The artist's picture of the river is this serpentine one with the curves that look very beautiful. The internal anatomy of the river is a series of sharp angles and turns, the internal anatomy of the river as a whole. And so here we have, in a sense, the artist capturing truly a dimension of the river, but the river also having this deeper anatomy. And of course, McLean, the artist, as he tells the story that flows through this particular book, A River Runs Through It, is faithful both to the angles and to the kind of beautiful shape that the story has, that he gives to it. I also, now this next paragraph is, notice the first few words, I also became the river. Okay? So he's talking about the processes by which he becomes what it is that he's remembering and writing about. I also became the river by knowing how it was made. The Big Blackfoot is a new glacial river that runs and drops fast. The river is a straight rapids until it strikes big rocks or big trees with big roots. This is the turn that is not exactly at right angles. Then it swirls and deepens among big rocks and circles back through them, where big fish live under the foam. As it slows, the sand and small rocks it picked up in the fast rapids above begin to settle out and are deposited, and the water becomes shallow and quiet. After the deposit is completed, it starts running again. Okay, so now he's shifted from the artist to the geologist, somebody who knows how this particular river was formed, how it was itself made, and talks about it for a while from that angle. But again, it's part of becoming the river, okay? Not just knowing about it, but part of becoming the river is knowing how it was made. Part of becoming the river is enlivening it with the waters of your own memory. So this is a whole process of how it is that you actually do merge, and he, the artist, actually merges with what it is that he's seeing here, this river. And I'm arguing how he actually merges in this book with these characters that in some sense spring from his own mind and in some sense actually lived lives that he knew and loved. Now he makes an amazing shift here that is very important to note, and will be even more important when we get to the actual theology here. On a hot afternoon, the mind can also create fish and arrange them according to the way it has just made the river. Now, if you look back to the preceding sentence, it really is a sentence on at the top of the preceding paragraph, the topic sentence there. That really says, I also became the river by knowing how it was made. And here he's claiming that he just made it, okay? So there, you can see there's a tension here between the artist as making that which the artist writes about and the artist as being always mindful how what he's writing about was in some sense already made, okay? So there's this kind of movement back and forth. And then, I'm not gonna read this whole paragraph, he talks about how the creative mind can even arrange the fish and even arrange them in different places in this river. But then, as though to remind us and himself that the creative artist doesn't have the kind of creative power that actually can make something out of nothing, after he's arranged all these fish in his imagination, notice how the paragraph ends, the mind can make all these arrangements, but of course the fish do not always observe them. Okay? The fish have a live The fish have lives of their own, as any fisherman knows. You can arrange them all you want in your imagination, but you're not finally their maker. They are not, and fishermen, as I say, know this. You can take this from personal testimony. They have minds of their own, and they don't always observe where I imagine they might be. To take a little digression here, there's a moment in the plot, one of my favorite moments, that happens in the last fishing trip that Paul and his brother take together. And it involves this kind of question about what fly to use. And Paul figures out something very important. And he comes over to talk to Norman about what he's figured out. And I want to read you what he says exactly there, because it's about fishing at one level. His brother says this, and the syntax here is very hard, and when the syntax gets very hard, you know something very important is going on in Norman, because normally his syntax is very simple. But here's what his brother says to him. All there is to thinking is seeing something noticeable, which makes you see something you weren't noticing, which makes you see something that isn't even visible. Now, in the context of the story, what Paul sees is that his brother's not catching anything. And this makes him notice that the flies that he was seeing, the stone flies, he doesn't see anymore, and he doesn't see even any dead ones. And that makes him see that the stone flies must not be floating on the top, but they must be beneath the water. That's something he can't see, but he does see by noticing these other two things. Okay? That's the context here. But the actual statement here is balanced against one the first time Norman goes fishing, when he says his thinking constantly and his feeling oscillated between hope and fear. Hope and fear. Hope that he would catch a fish, fear that he wouldn't be able to land it if he did. Okay? And now we come to this part where his brother tells him that thinking is noticing something that's noticeable, which leads you to see something you weren't noticing, which leads you to see things that are invisible. To make a long story short, I always quote Hebrews, the first verse of chapter 11 now, when people look and see if I've caught anything, I say, what I've got in here, when they look at the fish, is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Okay? Gives my fishing a kind of exalted status. But actually, that's how in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 1, faith is understood. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. You can't give a better description of what you got when a fisherman finally lands a big trout. There's the substance of something hoped for right there. And the way you fish is to, if you're a good fisherman, engage in the kind of process Paul has recommended, where you can actually produce evidence of things not seen. So that's a little digression, but that's just a kind of another of the many little motifs in here about the great Christian virtues, love and faith and hope, that you have. Okay, now let's pick up our passage again after that long digression. He goes on to talk in that central paragraph on page 63 about fishermen. So we've gone from artists to geologists, and now we're to fishermen. Fishermen also think of the river as having been made with them partly in mind. And they talk of it as if it had been. They speak of the three parts as a unity and call it a whole. And the fast rapids they call the head of the whole, and the big turn they call the deep blue or pool, and the quiet, shallow water below they call the tail of the hole, which they think is shallow and quiet, so they can have a place to wade across and try the other side. So this is a notion here that the fisherman composed the river with one set of interests in mind. The artist composes the river with another set of interests in mind, that the serpentine, beautiful curve, etc. So there are different ways of sort of seeing the river here. And here we're having an artist who's also a fisherman, who's also a theologian, giving us that river, both making it and telling us how it was made at the same time, and in that way becoming it, okay? So we got theology, we got art, we got fishing, we've got composition going on in all sorts of ways here in this beautiful passage. Now watch what happens. And this is something that, as I said yesterday, also happens in Young Men in Fire. We get to a moment when we're told the moment at which the story that this is was first conceived. As the heat mirages on the river in front of me danced with and through each other, I could feel patterns from my own life joining with them. Okay, this merger of the patterns within his own life, merging with mirages and those patterns and merging with the river. It was here, while waiting for my brother, that I started this story. Although, of course, at the time, I did not know that stories of life are often more like rivers than books. But I knew a story had begun, perhaps long ago, near the sound of water. And I sensed that ahead I would meet something that would never erode, so there would be a sharp turn. Deep circles, a deposit, and quietness. Now, of course, that's an echo of what he's described as geological terms on the preceding page as to the character of that river. The fisherman even has a phrase to describe what he does when he studies the patterns of a river. He says he is reading the water. And perhaps to tell his stories, he has to do much the same thing. Then one of his biggest problems is to guess where and at what time of life, I'm continuing now, at what time of day life lies ready to be taken as a joke, and to guess whether it is going to be a little or a big joke. Is it going to be comic or not? And what's just about to happen in this story is very comic. For all of us, though, it's much easier to read the waters of tragedy. And then his brother joins him. So there you sort of have, in the story itself, the moment at which the story itself is first conceived, even before the story itself is ended, which suggests, again, that in a certain way, the story precedes its own composition in a kind of way, which is another way of making this point I made earlier, that the artist is both finding and making story at one and the same time. But what then, you might ask, does this have to do with theology? Well, if you look now at the other text, and see how this whole book ends, it ends, eventually all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters. Now, that particular passage is set up beautifully by a conversation that he has with his father, as the two of them now are in this sacred space. By now we've learned in the book that somebody's sitting on a riverbank, as he just was in that reverie I just read. Something wonderful is going to be seen or happen or thought. And now he joins his father on this riverbank, and the two of them have the following conversation, which gives you a context for the passage that I've just read. They're talking about the book that his father is reading on the riverbank, which happens to be the Bible, which happens to be the Greek New Testament, and that happens to be the opening of the Gospel of John. I scrambled up the bank and asked him, "How many did you get?" He said, "I got all I want." I said, "But how many did you get?" He said, "I got four or five." I asked, "Are they any good?" He said, "They are beautiful." So then he goes on to say, "What have you been reading?" "A book," he said. It was on the ground on the other side of him. Now, he's also been reading the Book of the River. So he's reading here the book, the Revelation, but also the river. And we've gotten that set up earlier by reading rivers, which is what the fishermen say they do. It was on the ground on the other side, so I would not have to bother to look over his knees to see it. He said, "It's a good book." Then he told me in the part I was reading, it says the Word was in the beginning. And that's right. I used to think water was first. But if you listen carefully, you will hear the words are underneath the water. "That's because you're a preacher first and then a fisherman," I said. If you ask Paul, he will tell you that the words are formed out of water. "No," my father said, "you are not listening carefully. The water runs over the words. Paul will tell you the same thing." So this argument about water and word, to I'm sure all of us in this room, when we talk about water and the word, we're in the whole element of baptism, right? Which is where these men have been, these two brothers, in each of the great four scenes. Now, what's at stake in the word being first? For a long time I said, well, now why would his father, a minister, have thought for most of his life, he says here, that the water came first? Well, if you go back to Genesis 1:1, you see the Spirit brooding on the face of the waters, and then God speaks, "Let there be light." So you could say, if you look at Genesis 1, that there's first the waters, and then there's the speech, then there's the word. But if you go to John, which is what the Father's reading, in the beginning was the Word. And the logos there can be translated not only word, but also pattern, design, that there's something out there in the world prior to our apprehension of it, prior to even our being created. Okay? So this is now to take this whole thing I've been talking about in literary terms, is the artist making up the stories or finding them, okay, or a little of both, into kind of a theological dimension grounded in this whole theology of creation that we get in the Gospel of John, and put into a little bit of contrast between the theology of creation that we get in Genesis 1. For Norman, it always had to be that there was a little of both. There was a creation. In fact, I think there's a suggestion here that he's even participating in the divine image by carrying on the work of creating things like stories. But he's not going to go so far as to say his own imagination can actually make the world. He's finding story that was there before he even wrote it down, even as he's also creating. And so there's that kind of both and understanding about the relationship between the human and the divine. What was made before we even came on the scene, and what we find, but also what we from time to time create. And this, it seems to me, is worked through here and through Young Men in Fire in astonishing ways. Not only beautiful writing, but as we saw yesterday in Young Men in Fire, here's a guy who spends the last 15 years of his life going into almost perilous conditions to find a particular story and to be able to show us as readers that the death of these 13 men really had a tragic shape. Not one that he imposed on it, but one that he found there. I'll pause here to see if there are some questions. I have a few other places I want to go with this, but this is kind of tough stuff. And just if you have questions or observations about the passages. So far, you're with me on this stuff? Okay. Up at Holden, you do get ideas you don't get many other places, and when I was preparing for this class and remembering that, and being reminded again in seeing the film, that one of the great influences on MacLean is Wordsworth, I got out some of Wordsworth's poetry. And I was looking for a particular passage because I wanted to figure out what might be some of the deep background in Wordsworth. For the long passage I just took you through there, when he's on the riverbank and he's merging with the river and telling you how he's becoming the river. Okay. So I'm going to read you this little passage from Wordsworth's poem, Tintern Abbey. And he's now at a point, and this is the great romantic insight, of both remembering what nature once seemed to him, but also sensing that it no longer can mean the same thing that it once did. And that's the context of this. He says, I cannot paint what then I was, that is, when he was a young boy. The sounding cataract haunted me, word that should ring a bell, like a passion. The tall rock, the mountain, and the deep and gloomy wood, their colors and their forms, were then to me an appetite, a feeling, and a love that had no need of a remoter charm by thought supplied, nor any interest unborrowed from the eye. That is, the simple apprehension of beauty was enough. I didn't have to add thought to it when I was a young boy. That time has passed, and all its aching joys are now no more, and all its dizzying raptures. Not for this faint eye, nor mourn, nor murmur. Other gifts have followed. For such loss I would believe abundant recompense, for I have learned to look on nature, not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still, sad music of humanity, nor harsh, nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man. So all of this is there, but it's also in the mind of man. There's this kind of interfusion of the mind with nature through thought. A motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Therefore am I still a lover of the meadows and the woods and mountains, and of all that we behold from this green earth, of all the mighty world of eye and ear, both what they have create and what perceive. Half creation, half perception, half making, half finding. Well pleased to recognize in nature the language of the sense, the anchor of my purest thoughts, the nurse, the guide, the guardian of my heart and soul, and all my moral being. Okay. Now that's from Tintern Abbey, and I emphasize there that same wonderful balance between perceiving things or finding things and making things. And a lot of the great cadences that you hear in that last page, A River Runs Through It, the haunting, the rolling through all things, this spirit of nature, etc., is right there. What startled me as I kind of recovered this poem, Tintern Abbey, which I looked up in the table of contents, is that I'd never noticed the subtitle, which is On Revisiting the Banks of the Wye River During a Tour. So all of this reflection takes place in Wordsworth while he is sitting on the banks of the Wye River. Now you can begin to see that probably Norman did have something like this passage in mind. He was a Wordsworth scholar. And I suppose to clinch the deal, the thing that happens in his book, just after the passage I read, the long one, is his brother comes up. And in the poem, what happens just after the passage I read, Wordsworth's sister comes up. and interrupts that particular reverie, okay? If Wordsworth had had a brother of the right age, I'm sure he'd come up there. So anyway, there's this kind of wonderful resonance there of the great Romantic poets, and I can tell you, it took me a long time to see. A lot of people think the Romantic poets are poets that are writing for the young. Believe me, they're not. They're writing for folks most of our age here, who are dealing with the whole complicated movement of remembering what things were like, dealing with what they are now, and having both a sense of great loss and a sense of great recovery, et cetera, et cetera. And that's also what's going on at another level, and River Runs Through It. But what I want you to see here, and I would have failed in my theological task if you leave here without seeing it, is that he takes that romantic vision out of Wordsworth that I've just been talking about, borrows a lot there, but he places it in this larger theological framework where the primary reference there is the Gospel of John. So there's a Christology in Maclean that you don't have in Wordsworth, both in this book and in Young Men in Fire. That what really anchors those patterns and designs, where the patterns of our lives merge with the patterns of nature, the patterns that are already there, we being a part of nature, is that nature was itself made, and the patterns in it were themselves placed there, because in the beginning was the Word. And that's basically what this whole last reverie that concludes this book is most certainly about. I'll stop there before turning briefly to Young Men in Fire. Questions? Comments? Still follow me on this? Yeah?
Well, one thing that I keep coming up with in my head, because of the relationship of the brothers and knowing that he did understand the Bible, is one who is closer than a brother, and the image of the closeness of the brother and the, you know, tying it all together. Just different things pop.
Very nice. Yes. The closeness of the two brothers, and also their closeness to the Father. Because each of them are very close to him. Norman, I think, more than Paul, although it's clear that Paul is the Father's favorite, and one of the leitmotifs in this book is that kind of sibling rivalry. It's kind of subdued, but it's always there.
Kind of a love-hate dichotomy.
No, that's right. Kind of a love-hate dichotomy. There's a beautiful passage. I think the last passage in River Runs Through It is, in a way, at one level, simply, we've already seen everything that's described there happen in the book. We've seen, in the passage I just read you, Norman merge with the river. I mean, that's what, in a sense, that whole passage is about. But let me read you another one that happens very near the end of the book, when the three of them are sitting together, side by side, Norman and his father, watching Paul fish. And this will get to your point on closeness. My father and I sat on the bank and laughed at each other. It never occurred to either of us to hurry to the shore in case Paul needed help with a rod in his right hand and a basket loaded with fish on his left shoulder. In our family, it was no great thing for a fisherman to swim a river with matches in his hair. We laughed at each other because we knew he was getting damn good and wet, and we lived in him and were swept over the rocks with him and held his rod in our hand. So it's a complete merger, a mind meld, I suppose, of these two watching Paul, lifting his rod with their hands and sort of, well, it says living in him. So you have this sort of, the more you read this book, the more you sort of see happening the very things that are lyrically described in the last great ending. They've already happened if you've been careful enough to notice them in the actual story. They're not sort of just added there at the end about all things merge into one and a river runs through it. I mean, that's been happening for the entire 100 pages, if you follow me. Okay, now just a brief additional theological remark here, because I'm not going to be able to take you through this book, and I have a little treat at the end that I want to end with. But I want to talk about the vocation of the writer, but I think the vocation of all of us in another theological point. This is him talking about his vocation as a writer in Young Men in Fire. He says, if a storyteller thinks enough of storytelling to regard it as a calling, unlike a historian, he cannot turn from the sufferings of his characters. A storyteller, unlike a historian, must follow compassion wherever it leads him. He must be able to accompany his characters even into smoke and fire and bear witness to what they thought and felt, even when they themselves no longer knew. The story of the Man Gulch fire will not end until it feels able to walk the final distance to the crosses with those who, for the time being, are blotted out by smoke. They were young and did not leave much behind them and need someone to remember them. So here we come again, the vocation of the storyteller is to follow these characters, he says here, through the virtue of compassion, to where they got to a point where they themselves had lost all thought and feeling, which in the coda of this book, he does. The third part, which I can't bear to try to read out loud. Now, in some ways, it looks like we're just talking about the vocation of the artist here. But as the book goes on, and as I said last time, he discovers along the way that he was born to write this particular story, that no one else on earth could have written Young Men in Fire, given the unique combinations of skills, practices, and insights and experiences that he'd had. And I think we're invited all the way to ask, well, what story were we born to write? And more deeply, what story was ours from all eternity and before we were formed in the womb that we discover as we live through it, and that, as somebody like Augustine did, looking back on his life, saw that it had a kind of providential shape to it all along. I mean, divine providence, I think, is something that can be discovered only retrospectively, not prospectively. And in a sense, Augustine's whole project is, in a sense, to uncover that shape to his own story, that he didn't give it, but that was given to it by God. And something of this same thing, it seems to me, Norman sees very much as his own vocation to tell this particular story. But I think he invites all of us to ask ourselves, and what story is ours? And beyond that, how does our story merge with and sometimes get exchanged for the story that has the cruciform shape that is Jesus' story? If I took you through all of the Young Men in Fire, you would see that that's where we wind up, at the crosses on a hillside. So there's a sense in which what happens there is that the story of the man and the storyteller himself merge with yet a larger story. So there's a kind of discovery of pattern in the world, multiple patterns, but there's also a sense of the pattern of our own lives merging with yet a larger particular pattern. That really, I think the theology of Young Men in Fire takes us further toward that view that even the theology of the river runs through it. Okay, I promised you a little surprise at the end, something a little lighter. It turns out that among the many other things that Young Men in Fire has spawned, I told you yesterday that it changed the way we fight forest fires. And the fact that the tragedy happened, I might also add, we're told in the book, changed the way firefighters are trained. And a woman who was here at one of the sessions, who may still be here, yes, said that it's required reading, right?
It's required reading.
In the Forest Service.
Firefighters.
For firefighters. Because your husband was a firefighter, or was in the Forest Service?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, so thank you for that, I was not aware of that. So that's one of the things that it's done. It's changed the way we train, and it's changed the way we fight fires. But it's also inspired some popular music. And there was a ballad written about this central character in Young Men in Fire, which I think is pretty good. That very faithfully tells the story, and for those of you who weren't here, I'll just mention, the central character in Young Men in Fire is a guy named Wag Dodge. And it's Wag Dodge who's the crew chief, and it's Wag Dodge who gets the brilliant idea as these men are trying to outrun the flames to set this famous bat fire. I should say escape fire. And when he lights the escape fire, he lies down in it, and it saves his life, and he beckons the others to join him there, but none of them do. And this is a ballad that very faithfully describes the day of August 5th, 1949, and that focuses on Wag Dodge. And the singer imagines that he is... should be some extra copies on the piano for those of you... Is there any extra copies we can pass upstairs? A couple people look along, but you have to see the words, that helps. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the singer in this imagines himself standing at the bedside, or the foot of the bed, of Wag Dodge as he's dying. And I thought I'd just end with this musical rendition of what happened on that particular day.
My name is Dodge, then you know that. It's written on the chart there at the foot end of the bed. They think I'm blind, I can't read it. I've read it every word, and every word it says is death. So confession, is that the reason that you came? Get it off my chest before I check out of the game. Since you mention it, well, there's 13 things I'll name. 13 crosses high above the cold Missouri water. August 49, North Montana. The hottest day on record, and the forest tend to dry. Lightning strike inland mountains. I was crew chief at the jump base. I prepared the boys to fly. Pick the drop zone. C-47 comes in low. Feel a tap upon your leg that tells you go. See the circle of the fire down below. 15 of us drop above the cold Missouri water. Gauge the fire, I'd seen bigger. So I ordered them to side hill, and we'd fight it from below. We'd have our backs to the river. We'd have it lit by morning, even if we took it slow. But the fire ground jumped the valley just ahead. There was no way down, headed for the ridge instead. Too big to fight it, we'd have to find that slope instead. Flames one step behind, above the cold Missouri water. Sky had turned red, smoke was boiling. 200 yards to safety, death is 50 yards behind. I don't know why, I just thought it. I struck a match to waste my grass, running out of time. Tried to tell them, step into this fire. I said, we can't make it, this is the only chance you'll get. But they cursed me, ran for the rocks above instead. I lay face never prayed above cold, blurry water. And when I rose like the phoenix, in that world reduced to ashes, there were none but to survive. I stayed that night, one day after, carried bodies to the river, wonder how I stayed alive. 13 stations up across to mark their fall. I've had my say, I'll confess to nothing more. I'll join them now, because they left me long before. 13 crosses high above the cold Missouri water. 13 crosses high above the cold Missouri shore.
Okay, thank you very much.